the Republicans to wake up is... With the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is supported by listeners. My thanks to Andrew Rush, Mary Gruber, Jeffrey Adair, and Grant Gibson. They're voluntary subscribers. You can do it, too. Just log on to peterbcollins.com. How about those Egyptians, huh?
All the old paintings on the tomb, they do the sand dance, don't you know? If they move too quick, oh, well, they're falling down like a dumb.
Let's all take a victory lap around Tahrir Square, Liberation Square. Yeah, proudly, shoulders high. And you can put your shoes back on, because Mubarak is gone. Now, there is much more to this developing story, and we will continue to cover it, but there is this moment of jubilation, as people power has won out, and despite the last-ditch effort by Mubarak to split the loaf and try to hang in there, the public reaction was overwhelming. And overnight, he decided to cash it in and get out while he still had his hide. And we're going to see now how this Army Council does taking over and exactly, you know, what the path forward will be. Hopefully it won't be just another brutal dictatorship replacing this one. But we do have to be prepared for all kinds of possibilities. And stay tuned here to the Peter B. Collins Show. We'll certainly update you in future podcasts as this important story continues. As promised, our program today is going to help you understand the story of Susan Lindauer, an American intelligence asset who knew too much and was willing to talk about it, silenced by the Bush administration and put through an ordeal that is harrowing and at times unbelievable. And it all revolves around the Patriot Act and the police state that it has helped spawn. Susan Lindauer has penned a new book called Extreme Prejudice, the subtitle, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. Susan, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here with you.
And before we dive into your story, may I offer an apology to you on behalf of thinking Americans who value our constitutional rights and who reject the notion of a creeping police state?
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I accept your apology provisionally that the American government still has to apologize to.
Well, that's what I was leading up to. Has anyone in a position of authority apologized to you for challenging your character, questioning your sanity, and locking you up to prevent you from telling the truth?
Right after my release from indictment, I was under indictment on the Patriot Act for 5 years. The United States government, some members of the United States Senate had meetings with me, and they responded by saying, well, you haven't told anybody about this, have you? And I said, not yet, but you haven't seen the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now my book is out, and it is a killer. It is the real story of Iraq and 9/11 that will blow your mind. For starters, we absolutely expected 9/11 to happen. Every politician who has ever told you that we didn't expect 9/11 is either a liar or a fool.
How about Condoleezza Rice, who said, "Well, maybe in the bowels of the agency, somebody knew."
Oh no. I had gone to the Attorney General John Ashcroft's private staff in August of 2001, and I went, and at their instructions, I immediately contacted the Office of Counterterrorism at the Justice Department in August of 2001, telling them that we were looking for any fragment of intelligence involving airplanes, airplane hijackings, airplane bombings. We were looking at the possibility of a mini nuclear device being used in a strike on the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
And we said I was instructed by my CIA handler to declare that I wasn't to explain that I was an asset connected to Iraq and Libya, and that I was in direct contact with those embassies. And the reason they had me make this phone call was because if I say Libya and Iraq and terrorism in a phone call, the importance of it should jump.
Well, and the key
to a very high level.
The key words,
did know this was coming.
The key words there would also now currently attract the attention of the NSA handler who is monitoring this phone call right now. But Susan, let's back up a little bit, because it's important to establish your bona fides here. You are working for our government. Well, let me even back up a little bit before that. You are a lifelong peace activist. And you are, I take it that you're a liberal person. You worked for a couple of Democrats on Capitol Hill, including Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon and Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren of San Jose. And so your background was in peacemaking, the peace movement, if you will. And as a result of that, you were seen by our government as somebody who would be a valuable asset, who could help bridge some of the contacts that had been broken off, say, as a result of the war against Iraq, the Desert Storm booting them out of Kuwait in the early 90s under President Bush Sr. And so you started working about 1993, first on the Oklahoma City bombing. The first
World Trade Center attack in 1993, and the Oklahoma City bombing
in 95.
In September of 94, I was introduced to my CIA handler. Dr. Richard Fuse was a major CIA operative in the 1980s in Beirut and Syria and Saudi Arabia. He was involved in the Terry Anderson hostage rescue, and he actually was part of the team that was identifying where all the hostages were being held. So he had infiltrated the Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm.
And the militant ranks of Hezbollah, and these were the most brutal, they brutally tortured these individuals. And Richard, in the course of that, discovered the Lockerbie conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
and that involved heroin trafficking out of the Bekaa Valley that was being sort of supported or tolerated by the CIA, by some factions of the CIA.
So, Susan, your CIA handler, Richard Fuse, had a rich background, and he brought you into the investigation into the Lockerbie bombing. And I don't want to go down that whole road because it's an interesting story, but fundamentally, you assert that Libya was not responsible and that the U.S. orchestrated a trial to convict the Libyan who has since been released for medical reasons back to Libya.
Yes, that is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Fuse has always stated that he knows who did the Lockerbie conspiracy and that no Libyan was involved with it at all.
Okay.
So
now,
because of my work against sanctions and my work against war, and my position was that I opposed violence in all directions, whether it was terrorism or war, I was in an excellent position to go deal with Libya and Iraq at the United Nations, which were countries under sanctions. And they are, the good news is that Arab governments, even hostile Arab governments or governments that are traditionally supportive of jihadi movements, have a great deal more respect for you if they realize that you are opposed to killing their families as well as when they kill our families.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get a lot farther with these people if you show consistency in dialogue.
Right.
And that is a very positive thing to discover, because in fact that is what changed Libya and pulled Libya away from its past was dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And you were able to engage in some pretty high level contacts with the Iraqi embassy in New York, and you had a boyfriend, a one time lover, who was a high ranking Iraqi official. So you had contacts, and everything that you did was disclosed to our government. You expected that you were monitored, that you were videotaped, and you got advance approval for travel to Iraq. You got payments for the work that you did and for the expenses that you incurred.
Well, no. There was no payment for my expenses, because at that point assets were not paid until the end of the project. So what ended up happening was my CIA handler was taking all the money for himself, and mm-hmm. he was not paying me, which ended up creating some very big problems down the road. But what he kept telling me was that he would pay me after the project was finished.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
He was very sleazy.
Well, and I think you're very generous, but I do agree with you based on your account that he was quite sleazy in the way he managed the reimbursements that you were due. My point is that you were an acknowledged asset. You were not covert in the sense that the intelligence officials in our country didn't know about you. In fact, the opposite was true. They were very well aware of the contacts that you made and of the intelligence that you produced. And so
they recruited me, they debriefed me, they supervised every single move that I was making. They were fully informed at all times. Nobody has to worry that an American citizen would go off dealing with, like, North Korea or Iran or, you know, some government like Libya and Iraq or Syria, and nobody would be paying attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely false. I was chosen because of my... I was known to be an anti-war and anti-sanctions activist. I was already highly... opinionated on these issues and very knowledgeable, and the Iraqi issue, particularly the Iraqi sanctions and the deaths of the Iraqi children, was already a well-known problem. And so I had wanted to get involved in trying to help solve that issue and trying to find a way in to deal with these problems. And the Iraqis were very grateful to have me, and the United States needed to keep a back channel open to those governments for terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was the key, is that, you know, even under sanctions, they had to have a way of gathering any information that the Iraqis or the Libyans would have on terrorism. And so my focus was first and foremost for that purpose. And it was... And Iraq was one of our very best sources on anti-terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the 1990s, Saddam hated the fundamentalists. He persecuted them. He was very harsh towards them, and he believed that eventually they would become enemies of his regime. So he tracked them very aggressively. And people have the wrong idea when they talk about Saddam and they try to say that he was connected to 9/11 or he supported Al Qaeda. Nothing could be worse disinformation.
Mm-hmm. And Susan, in the cycle, the year running up to our invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, you were in nearly constant touch with your Iraqi contacts. And they put forward a 6-point plan that most Americans have never heard of and have no idea that the government of Saddam Hussein was as forthcoming as it was. In reality, they offered full support for America's Arab-Israeli peace process, support for U.S. strategic interests in the region, some pretty delicious ways of giving U.S. Companies, U.S.-based multinationals, Iraqi oil contracts, the offer of elections within 2 years, and Saddam was willing to step down at that time. We don't know if he would have put one of his sons up to run, but at least that was part of the offer. Disarmament, including the agreement or the offer that the U.S. could send 5,000 troops into Iraq to search for weapons of mass destruction. And they offered full cooperation in the so-called war on terror. And this is...
Absolutely, that's true. And this was developed in the 2 years before the invasion. It was not a last-minute appeal. It was something that had been developed from pretty much from the start of the Bush administration. And the Iraqis were willing to give special... One more thing, they were willing to give special contracts to American corporations in telecommunications, transportation, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, hospital equipment. They offered to buy 1 million American-made automobiles every year for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
The peace framework was very comprehensive, and the CIA had demanded a hard bargain. They were the CIA. You know, you may hate the CIA. You may love the CIA, but the point is the CIA had an obligation to kind of protect American strategic interests and to keep the United States in control of the agenda. And so what had happened was at the end of the Clinton administration in that last year, international support for sanctions had collapsed. People were sick and tired of watching the Iraqi children die. They couldn't stand this anymore. They could not ignore that a genocide was taking place in Iraq. The Iraqi government was urging these governments to, was wooing them with sweetheart deals for oil and all sorts of, you know, economic reconstruction projects.
Mm-hmm.
And there began to be humanitarian flights from into Baghdad International Airport, in which the United Nations and the United States first tried to claim was a violation of the sanctions. But I will tell you that if you think that an individual cannot make a difference, I could never have done my work if the German pilots who had the courage they essentially had a Berlin airlift. They were from Germany who did it. And they copied the Berlin airlift, and they broke the sanctions, and they started flying in humanitarian supplies and medical equipment and doctors and nurses to help the people of Iraq. And when the CIA saw that, they knew that the sanctions were done. It was going to fall apart. It could not continue. And that's when the CIA did something which the CIA is supposed to do. They were proactive. They recognized that they were losing control of the situation, so they said they authorized me to conduct back-channel covert negotiations with Iraq for the resumption of the weapons inspections, economic benefits for the United States, oil for the United States, cooperation on terrorism, big time. And the thing is, the CIA is supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you hate the CIA, but this time the CIA got it right. And the CIA was trying to control the issue so that the United States would come out on top.
Now, as a result of these very high-level back-channel contacts that you were able to establish and pursue, you got information in advance of 9/11 that attacks were imminent, that airplanes would be used, and to borrow the phrase that Richard Clark popularized, you were running around more or less with your hair on fire, trying to alert people, high-level people in our government, including your second cousin, Andy Card, who was the chief of staff to George W. Bush. You also notified Secretary of State Colin Powell by dropping off letters at his home. So
that was about the peace agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that was about the peace agreement.
I understand. My point is that you were trying to work this in a very positive way You were trying to avert a U.S. invasion of Iraq, and this went along okay. You didn't get in any trouble until a couple of years later, you tried to share this information with the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Well, I actually contacted the offices of Senator John McCain and Senator Trent Lott, asking to testify on Capitol Hill for a brand new blue ribbon presidential commission. And I won, and I told, thanks to the Patriot Act, you gotta love the Patriot Act. You see, the Patriot Act is supposed to sting people like me. But what they did was they created a permanent record of the real facts of Iraqi pre-war intelligence. And so we have this on government FBI wiretap, me on the phone with Senator Trent Lott's staff, telling them about the peace agreement with the Iraqis and how it would have solved all the problems, including having democratic elections in Iraq with full rights of the Iraqi exiles to be repatriated and to contribute to the political life of the country. And it's all documented. And that's a very important thing in my book, Extreme Prejudice. It's all heavily documented. Mm-hmm. But when I went there and I asked to testify, 30 days later, I wake up one morning and I hear banging on my door, and it's the FBI with an arrest warrant, and their response to my request to testify was to indict me on the Patriot Act. And I became the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act. And it was done so that Congress could lie, could deceive the American people, could actively deceive, knowledgeably deceive. They knew they were lying to you, and they deceived you about Iraq. They deceived you about 9/11. We had known about 9/11. Let's, you know, just take a deep breath and just understand this. We did expect 9/11 to happen. And I realize that most of your audience is just kind of, you've been lied to so badly you don't even want to hear this anymore. The facts are, we did know. Iraq made a beautiful effort to contribute to the 9/11 investigation. They offered us financial documents on al-Qaeda figures that would have allowed us to shut down the financial pipeline feeding terrorism around the world, from the Indonesia and the Philippines over to Syria, over the Bekaa Valley, over to Afghanistan, down to Colombia, all through this area. The currency of terrorism is heroin trafficking. Mm-hmm. So you actually would have gotten both at the same time. And yet the Bush administration, let's all say no to drugs, except if it's heroin profits from al-Qaeda. I mean, why would you want to protect these people? But that's what the government did.
Now, Susan, it's very important to establish here, because I'm one of those people who's called a truther. I personally went to Washington and observed the work of the 9/11 Commission and was shocked but not surprised by the way they whitewashed and covered up and avoided critical questions. So tell me what your position is. What do you believe we do or don't know about the events of 9/11? And do you go so far as to speculate that it was, quote-unquote, an inside job?
Yes, it was. I do. The 9/11 Commission was to call it a farce would be very polite.
Yes.
I think the FCC would shut you down if I said what I really think about the 9/11 Commission. It's so loaded with expletives at this point. It's an obscenity.
Well, let me liberate you, Susan, because we're not at least at this point on this program, we're not operating under FCC rules, so you can cuss a blue streak if you want.
Okay, well, here's what you need to know. I learned about the 9/11 warnings not from the Iraqis or the Libyans or from any Arab. I learned about it from the CIA. My CIA handler told me that we were looking for a conspiracy involving airplane hijackings in April of 2001. And he instructed me to threaten the Iraqi diplomats with war if the 9/11 attack occurred, and if it turned out that the Iraqis had any information which they had not shared with us. So I went up to New York and I had my polite little, I had meetings with the Iraqi diplomats all the time. I met with them. I'd been meeting with them about every 2 or 3 weeks, you know, since August of 1996. So by 9/11, I've had a long relationship with these people, and I know them very well. And I say, you know, hey, if you hear anything about airplane hijackings, let me know. I go back to Richard Fuse. I said, hey, I gave him the message. He said, what did they say? And I said, oh, I was really polite. He said, I didn't tell you to be polite. I told you to tell those motherfucking goddamn blah blah blankety 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 SOB blah 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 that we were going to bomb them into the bloody Stone Age if they don't give us this information. And he screamed and ranted and raged and stormed up and down his office. I've never seen him yell at me this way. And he was adamant that Iraq had to give us this information. And from that point on, from May of 2001, I knew this was a serious conspiracy. They were already fully aware of it. And they kept over and over in the summer of 2001, I was instructed at practically every single meeting we talked about the 9/11 warnings. And I met with Richard Fuse once a week, and I would say that at most of those meetings we discussed the worries about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Fuse kept telling me that I had to get the Iraqis to give us any fragment of intelligence, even something very small that I might not understand, a number, a name. You know, they had already targeted it. By June, we knew that it involved a strike on the World Trade Center. This was a very well-developed plan. But I was told to instruct the Iraqis that at the highest levels of the government, far above the CIA director or the Secretary of State. Now, think who that could be.
Well,
above the CIA director, above the Secretary of State, that those people at the very top of the government had made the decision that if 9/11 happened, there would be a war with Iraq.
So that's the president and the vice president and their
staffs. Got it. Mm-hmm. And their immediate cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they had already decided what they were going to do. And that, to me, indicates why there was a command failure, a negligence issue. They deliberately stood down from taking easy actions like alerting NORAD. NORAD had been training for 2 years, as you all know, on a 9/11 scenario. This was based on Project Bojinka, which
right.
was Ramzi Youssef's attack
mm-hmm.
design. This was very well known. And they could easily have implemented the defense mechanisms for through NORAD. They chose not to do it. I know from in August of 2001, I was told to stop going to New York because the attack was imminent, and we expected mass casualties, and it might involve a mini nuclear device.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was told to stay out of New York City, and that the attack would happen at any moment. When I was writing my book, I was told by a high-ranking State Department fellow that with a very high level of security clearance that strange trucks were documented to have entered the building, the World Trade Center towers, at between 3 o'clock in the morning and leaving by before 5 o'clock in the morning, and that this had happened for approximately 10 days to 12 days in the 2 weeks prior to 9/11. So
mm-hmm.
this happened at the end of the end of August to early September.
Okay.
And
just 1 second. Where did that noise come from? Is that the NSA?
I don't know. That's a very interesting noise, isn't it?
Are you on a cordless phone?
Yes, cordless phone.
Oh,
but
okay.
That's not. But I'll tell you something. Whenever I start to do these interviews, strange things like this start to happen. Just keep that in mind.
Okay. So
it only happens when I start talking about 9/11.
That's very interesting. Let me ask you this then. Do you conclude that Bush and Cheney, if we narrow it to the top two decision makers, that they let it happen or that they were in on a larger scheme that included wiring the buildings? Because I'm one of those people who doesn't believe that the airliners could cause the total collapse of the Twin Towers.
You are absolutely correct. And that's why the fact that these trucks, these vans, were seen arriving at 3 o'clock in the morning and leaving before 5 o'clock in the morning, they have been identified as separate from the janitorial services. Okay, this is very, very important. And the person who told me that he could personally identify what the trucks, the janitorial trucks, looked like, and he could absolutely assure me that there had never been trucks like, they were minivans.
Mm-hmm.
They're minivans, not trucks. I'm using the word trucks. Minivan trucks. They had never been there prior to this very small interval of time.
Mm-hmm.
And he is convinced that that's when they wired the buildings.
Okay.
And he said that we know that these people were there. We know that something was going on in that building that was an unusual occurrence that had never happened before, and then after about 10 days it stopped happening.
Mm-hmm.
So so I do believe the buildings were wired, and I'll tell you why my story is so important is because it explains motive and opportunity. The United States government had already decided to go to war with Iraq. We were already threatening Iraq with war before 9/11 ever happened. And that created a motive for somebody who knew that the 9/11 attack was going to happen, and they knew that most terrorist attacks have minimal damage. Now, they're noisy, they're chaotic, they cause a lot of screaming and shrieking and smoke and dazzling, and all the media comes running down to see what's happened. But when the smoke clears, most terrorist attacks have a very small level of damage,
mm-hmm.
and a few people die. In the 1993 World Trade Center attack, 5 people died. In the USS Cole in October 2000, 12 people died. Okay, so anybody who really knows terrorism is going to know that those airplanes are not going to have an impact that will be sufficient to throw the United States into war with Iraq. Somebody had to make sure that there was maximum devastation so that they could fulfill their agenda, which had already been discussed. It had already been decided that if this was a bad enough attack, they could have war in Iraq. So that was the motive, and that was the opportunity. And I'm convinced that's what they did. I just know it is what they did.
We're talking with Susan Lindauer here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Her new book is called Extreme Prejudice. And let's take a moment here to tell people how they can get a copy of the book, Susan. What's the best way to purchase it?
You can get it on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, great.
And that's the best way.
Uh-huh. And just a quick aside, did you shop this to major publishers, and was there a lack of interest?
Well, I will tell you. The major publishers all wrang their hands. They said, do you really have to tell people all of this? Do you really think they need to know all of this?
Hmm.
And that was the reaction, was, why rock the boat? Do you have to tell, people want to feel good. They don't necessarily want to know the truth.
Wow. Okay, so much for publishing. Now, mm-hmm. let's go back to your story. You are picked up by the FBI a month after you contacted John McCain and Trent Lott's offices, offering to support the so-called Blue Ribbon Commission that was going to investigate 9/11.
And Iraq.
And
there were two of them.
That's right.
There was
mm-hmm.
a 9/11 commission and a Senate investigation on 9/11, and there was a Senate investigation and 9/11 and Blue Ribbon Commission on Iraq.
Okay.
There were two of them.
And so at what point were you allowed to review the charges that were made against you?
Well, the amazing thing about the Patriot Act, which Congress is about to take up again and is thinking of extending, is that under the Patriot Act, there are secret charges, there are secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. You don't even expect this stuff in America. You cannot imagine that anybody could even try to get away with this stuff. But under the Patriot Act, this is how they operate.
Mm-hmm.
And in 5 years under indictment, I was never allowed to read one single grand jury statement against me. Not even one. I was not allowed to see under 5 years, I was not allowed to read one single FBI witness interview. Now, if you have any attorneys in your audience, I'm sure you do, they'll be like, what are you talking about? How can you put together a case if you're not allowed to know what the charges are and you're not allowed to see the evidence? And the evidence that they did show us was paltry. I was accused of eating three lunches totaling $92.92 with Iraqi diplomats. And so it was a cheeseburger, French fries, and a Coke. $92.92. And that's the only thing they could show as evidence of criminal behavior. But under the Patriot Act, you've all heard of warrantless searches. Well, when they convened the grand jury, they really didn't have any evidence to give the grand jury. So what they did was they did a secret search of my house. And we know that they did this because they managed to break the door. They broke my front door when they came in.
Mm-hmm.
And they went through my papers to see if they could find anything to show the grand jury. Now, usually you do not convene a grand jury until after you know that there's criminal activity.
Right.
But in the case of the Patriot Act, if you need to indict an activist who's making trouble or a whistleblower who's making trouble, you can convene. You go ahead and convene the grand jury first, and then you can come in and sneak into the person's house and rifle through their papers and try to find something that will help you support the indictment. And in my case, we suspect that they did not find anything, and that's when they had to resort to the secret charges and the secret evidence, because otherwise they couldn't have. There was no evidence to give the grand jury of criminal activity. There was nothing to give them. They couldn't give us anything.
Mm-hmm. And you know that at some point your assigned public defender, Sanford Tolkien, he signed a confidentiality agreement. So he was shown some of the so-called secret evidence or the secret charges.
Actually, let me tell you. This was a very, what the government did to me was they indicted me, and at first I was free on bail.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, the presumption was that I would have a trial. But what was happening was the war was going extremely badly. And the Congress was, having the assets. All the assets had been indicted. Unfortunately, I was not the only one. All of the assets were indicted. My co-defendants were also assets covering Iraq. And with all the assets out of the way, Congress began to make up stories. They began to tell you, convoluted, twisted schematics about how assets had failed to produce good intelligence. And it was not Congress's fault for going to war. The assets, the incompetence of the assets, the failure of the assets was to blame for the intelligence work before that produced the invasion. Okay. And so Congress really decided they liked that story. They didn't have to take any responsibility for their actions at all. And so, having invented this story, then they turned to the CIA and said, but you have to protect us. You have to keep us in power. If the American people hear that we've been lying to them, they'll throw us out. They'll think we're a bunch of bums, and we'll be sent packing off Capitol Hill. So you have to shut this woman up. Okay, so at that point, there was a terrible thing was done, in my opinion, to me. my public defender was trying to find an angle for the case, and he had said to me, have a psychiatric evaluation just to see if there's anything we can use, like post-traumatic stress, is there any possible angle that we can talk about because of the 9/11 warnings? Maybe, you know, we can say that the 9/11 warnings had so, you know, had really upset, which they had. 9/11 had hurt me very badly, and maybe we can use this in our defense. So there were some legitimate things that they that he was talking about using in the
case. Well,
but
Susan, let me interject, because the idea that you had any kind of mental issues, either depression, suicidal tendencies, or that you somehow were not competent to manage your own legal affairs, all of that was trumped up by the government. And they used it at certain points to put you in solitary confinement.
Exactly. What they did was, this was presented to me as a very innocuous thing. Oh, have, you know, talk to this defense psychiatrist. Let's see if there's anything we can use. About 2 weeks after that interview, my attorney attended a classified debriefing at the Justice Department. Now, again, we're going deep into the Patriot Act here. The Patriot Act requires that attorneys will keep secret any conversations with the prosecution or with the Justice Department. So the prosecutor can tell the attorney things that the attorney's not allowed to communicate to the client,
right,
to the defendant.
Sure.
That is against everything in our legal system, by the way. But under the Patriot Act, that's how they do business. And so there was a secret debriefing that I was not even told about. I did not discover this until after my case was dismissed. 2 weeks after this secret debriefing, I was declared incompetent to stand trial. Now, again, I was not told, I was not told that I had been declared incompetent to stand trial. I was kept totally in ignorance of everything. I believed that we were still going to have a trial, and I was pushing my attorney very hard to have one. I was like, go ahead and schedule this thing. Come on, let's get moving. I want to resolve this matter. I want to go to trial. I want to have my day in court. And my public defender was doing a really lousy job. So I have an uncle. I am not a passive person.
Now, wait. Susan, just before we get to Uncle Ted, because he's a real hero here.
Yeah.
As I read your book, I just thought that you were way too kind to Sanford Talkin. At minimum, he is guilty of intentional ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think beyond that, he colluded with the government, and he compromised your legal and personal interests time and time and time again. And we've got a series of problems here. One is that you were matched up with him through the public defender program. He had no real experience in a national security case like this, and they rolled over him repeatedly at great cost to you.
Oh, yes. I had to be very careful that I could, believe it or not, even though he has done this to me, in print, I still have to be careful of libel. So I had to be very careful about what I said, even though he absolutely did everything you just said. And it went so far that I was ordered to go to, I was summoned into court, and my attorney and Sam Talkin said, I have no idea why you're coming to court today, Susan. And I said, you know, and I had my Uncle Ted, I called up my Uncle Ted, I said, something's going on here. And he flew in from California.
And he's a seasoned attorney, he's 70 years old, and he grasped the issues of your case almost immediately.
Almost, yes, definitely. And he interviewed my witnesses. Now, the extraordinary thing about my public defender was that in the first 18 months of my case, my public defender refused to interview my witnesses. Now, doesn't that sound strange? He refuses to talk to the people who can verify my story. But my uncle, who is also an attorney with 40 years' experience, jumps in. He interviews the witnesses. We can prove the case hands down. It's very easy.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is I get called into court, and my attorney tells me in it all the way to the courthouse. We're walking down to the courthouse. He says, I don't know what they're going to do to you. I just have no idea. And we get in there, and there is the reports from the psychiatrists declaring that I am incompetent to stand trial and that I am incurable because Now, the incompetence finding is most dangerous, in my opinion. It was this: my belief in my innocence was so strong that I could not appreciate the gravity of the charges. And the other psychiatrist said that my desire to prove my innocence by pursuing witnesses and leads qualified as a mental defect. Okay? The desire to pursue evidence and witnesses and leads to show that I was innocent of the charges qualified as a mental defect. So long as I wanted to prove my innocence, I would be incompetent of having my day in court.
And so this, from my reading of your case, was an intentional effort to try to paint you as a crazy lady so that when you told the truth about what you knew about the intelligence about Iraq and all the issues that we've covered so far, that they could just say, well, she's crazy. She's, Andy Card knows she's a loon. And so this was a very carefully orchestrated effort to marginalize your credibility because they knew they couldn't really bring a case against you, and they simply wanted to use whatever legal means available to them to silence you.
Exactly. Exactly. And as a result of this, I was ordered to I was never allowed to have a trial in 5 years. On that terrible day in September, I was ordered to surrender to prison on a Texas military base, Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas. And I was held, or I was supposed to be held, for 4 months.
Well, now, let's say they said maybe 60 days, but up to 4 months, and ultimately you were held on an indefinite basis, and then they surprised you with a release about 7 months after you arrived.
It was actually 11 months.
Oh, 11.
I was held at Carswell Air Force Base 7 months and then transferred to the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York,
right,
where I was held for an additional 4 months.
Correct, okay.
But I will tell you that I have never been so terrified in my life, and I have great sympathy for what Bradley Manning is going through, because there is nothing more horrible than being denied the right to know, one, what you are accused of doing, what is the evidence against you? And then I was threatened with indefinite detention up to 10 years in prison with no trial.
Mm-hmm.
The Justice Department actually argued in the court of Judge Mukasey that I should be detained at Carswell and forcibly drugged with Haldol, which is a rhinoceros tranquilizer that imitates the stone-like effects of Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I should be detained. My cure would take several years. They couldn't say how long, but it would be a very long time, they told the judge, because the depth of my delusions, my fantasy, my belief that I had really been an asset was so deep and so intense that I had better, I would require pretty much the full term in order to get be cured.
And
now,
Susan,
the thing about it was that the FBI indictment depended on the fact that I did have these relationships at the Iraqi embassy. I did do all these things. So on one hand, you have the insanity of the Justice Department declaring that I had broken the law by involving myself in these activities. And then you have these crazy people with psychology degrees coming on saying, oh, because she thinks she did these activities, she must be delusional, and therefore she should be locked up.
And well, Susan,
like, how can you? And the judge was anyway. So,
thank you. Let me in for a minute. One of the things that occurs to me is what you're describing is completely consistent with the Soviet Union's gulag, that you were inconvenient to the regime and therefore were sending you out for re-education. And this is a little more modern than what the Soviet era and the Stalinists did. But we're going to use drugs, and we're going to use compromised psychiatrists and other medical professionals who are doing the bidding of our government, not honoring the Hippocratic Oath or any other obligation that they have to the best interests of the patient.
That is absolutely correct. And let's remember, this is a prison. It is not a mental hospital. It is a prison on a military base. Okay, and during this time, I was denied access to an attorney. My public defender refused to come see me, but I still had my wonderful, beloved Uncle Ted Lindauer, mm-hmm. who is a true hero in this book, and he made 3 trips from his home in Illinois down to Fort Worth, Texas, 700 miles. In each direction, and they would refuse to let him enter the military base. They told him that there was no prison on the base.
Yeah.
They actually said this. Then they said that the prison had no visiting hours on the weekends, which was another lie. And then and by this time, Uncle Ted was not playing around, and he went to Judge Mukasey, and he demanded that Judge Mukasey should have U.S. Marshals standing by to escort him onto the military base, so that he would be able to visit with me, and he was trying to broker a solution to the whole mess. And so, you know, Judge Mukasey saw, and this is Judge Mukasey who later becomes U.S. Attorney General, mm-hmm. Judge Michael Mukasey.
Well, let's spend a few minutes here about Judge Mukasey, because this is the other thing that really galls me about your book, frankly, Susan. And maybe it is libel considerations. He's a public figure, though, so I don't think they apply. You are so goddamn nice to this guy that I couldn't believe it. And he was the one who sent you to Carswell for this psychiatric evaluation. He accepted the government's claim. And while he ultimately moved to dismiss your case, it didn't happen on his watch. He went to Washington as the Attorney General, where he extended the bad precedent of the Patriot Act through unilateral assertion of FBI no-knock letters, an expansion of the national security letters to make it even easier for an FBI agent to just barge into your home without any basis, without probable cause, without honoring the Fourth Amendment. And so I have no warmth for Judge Mukasey whatsoever, and in your book, you're just slobbering all over the guy.
Well, I will tell you that Judge Mukasey, my case was, an attorney will tell you that some cases make bad law. My case would tear down the entire United States court system for all defendants, because my case had every bell and whistle, all the bells and whistles of the Patriot Act. And he would literally be required to do things that should be under, like, you know, the Soviet system, or you'd see them in Iran, or mm-hmm. the Nazis would do this, or North Korea would do this kind of stuff. And so when he first accepted the incompetence finding against me, which was very insulting, he did it without giving me a hearing, which turned out to be a grave mistake. He was looking at this. My uncle, who is a very astute attorney, was convinced that Judge Mukasey was looking for a way to get the case out of his courtroom. I had been under indictment for 18 months by this point, and I had been free. And the Justice Department came, and they came with a Trojan horse, if you will. They said, well, you know, this is only for 4 months, Your Honor. The original order was that I could only be detained for a maximum of 120 days. And this would be for an extended psychiatric evaluation. If the prison decided that I was totally competent to stand trial, which is what they should have done, then I would have been out in, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. And from a judge's perspective, he was giving my, you know, most criminal defense attorneys will tell you that my judge was giving the defense a chance to try to resolve the case and to make the thing go away.
Oh, but Susan, Susan, Susan.
The prosecution did a double cross.
Well, but Mukasey was part and parcel of the prosecution.
Oh, yeah.
He was He was helping orchestrate their case. He kept it alive without giving you a trial, which you're constitutionally entitled to, a speedy trial. So
I do not see how. Yes, believe me, yes.
But Susan, how can you be putting a white hat on Michael Mukasey?
Well, when I was detained, not only did they try to hold me, they argued for the right to forcibly drug me.
Right.
And when that happened, that became, I will tell you, the most terrifying experience of my entire life. The prison psychiatrist, it's even more obscene than your audience is understanding. The prison psychiatrist had documented that I showed no signs of violent behavior towards myself or to anyone or to property. They documented in all the reports that I was smiling, cooperative, good eye contact, strong intellectual ability, good functioning, good health. I was not weeping. I was not hysterical. There was nothing wrong with me. I was not demonstrating any symptoms of any sort of anything. Not only that, my witnesses had confronted the psychiatrists with the truth about my 9/11 warning and my work as an asset. We were never passive. It's like when my public defender couldn't do the job, I got my uncle to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my uncle confronted the prison psychiatrist and said, I personally have interviewed her witnesses. Her story is true. And my witnesses called them up and said, her story is true. And then these people went out to Judge Mukasey, and they falsified their testimony. And they said, Your Honor, she keeps saying that she warned about 9/11, but that's a fantasy. Gosh, she should be drugged until she stops saying this. Well, it wasn't, that's a pretty profound lie. When you talk about covering something up, and you talk about cover-ups, and this is like a Soviet gulag situation, as you just said. Michael Mukasey was confronted by a very, recognized that I had a very powerful enemy against me who was very frightened.
Mm-hmm.
They were holding on for power for dear life, and these are some of the ugliest, most vicious, hateful people. I despise the leaders of our country who did this, because they were willing, their self-importance is so great that they wanted to stay in power, and they were willing to do anything, even throw American citizens in prison without a trial in order to do it. And I do believe that Judge Mukasey accepted the incompetence verdict against me because he wanted to give my defense a way to get out of the case. And he ended up holding me in prison for 11 months, from a judge's perspective, and you have to realize in a federal court system, judges had up right up until the end of my, at the time of my arrest, and there had been mandatory sentencing. And so the mandatory sentencing had just been struck down, but judges were still guided by those guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
They were strongly influenced by those guidelines. They had been trained to accept those guidelines as the inevitable consequence of sentencing. And so a judge who's used to sentencing to people to 10 or 20 years in prison, he's going to look at a four-month sentence as a slap on the wrist.
Susan, I'm sorry. I can't accept these rationalizations.
Oh, I think it's terrible.
Because, Susan, hold on. Susan,
I'm defending Judge Mukasey because I'm the one who went through this, and I was like, in my book, here's the thing. I'm glad we're talking about this. In my book, I tried to be fair because I tried to explain why Judge Mukasey might have done this. And if he, because he's either that or he's a terrible crook. Well, because this kind of thing is so terrible. To throw somebody in prison without a trial is and refuse to give them a trial.
Now, Susan,
it's about
Susan,
as evil as you get. I mean,
stop.
It's just horrible that they did it.
Susan,
and
Susan,
the
Susan, please.
The horrible thing was the psychiatrist kept saying, that it was in my mind that it was insane. The indictment declared that I had done these actions, and the whole indictment was dependent on the fact that these actions had occurred. And then you had the crazy psychiatrist saying, well, Susan Lindauer says these actions occurred. She admits these actions occurred. She must be delusional for believing that these actions occurred. And it's like, but if the actions did not occur, and we have them on wiretaps, we had 28,000 wiretaps, we had 8,000 emails, we had hundreds of captured faxes that were date and time stamped to prove transmission. They had gone through my computers. We have the manila envelope from Colin Powell's house, where he lived next door to my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse. And so I, because of the FBI investigation, there is such a wealth, a treasure trove of evidence proving the real story of pre-war intelligence, which is totally different than what the people were told.
Susan?
And sorry.
May I get in for a moment?
Sure. Sorry. Yes.
I appreciate what you're saying, but the torrent of words just kind of support a notion that I'm feeling. Are you familiar with Stockholm Syndrome?
Yes.
Well, I feel that you're being so generous to your captors. And here's the way I see it. Now, Michael Mukasey did ultimately rule against the government's efforts to forcibly drug you. And that's a good thing. But he took a long time to do it. He incarcerated you for 11 months. He ignored your right to a speedy trial. And in my view, he participated in the effort to silence you and the cover-up of the illegal actions taken against you. And he was rewarded for that by being selected as the replacement for Alberto Gonzalez, the fumbling guy who couldn't remember a damn thing from the meetings he'd been to. And Mukasey came in, and what he did was put a new face on the police tactics, the police state tactics employed by the Bush administration, which you are one of the primary recipients of. And he went on to harden many of those policies during his short term as the attorney general at the end of Bush's presidency. And so I just have to say that the thing that galls me most about your book is the way you treat Michael Mukasey with kid gloves.
Well, that, Stockholm Syndrome, that could be fair. That could be true. That could be a fair assessment. That could be a fair assessment. Because he did hold my life in his hands, and I will tell you that I was just so profoundly grateful that he didn't drug me. I was so terrified of that threat. I was not able to, I became just, it was a crippling threat. It was every moment that I was awake, I was conscious of the danger that I was in. I hate drugs. I don't put drugs in my body. And I love my life. I've had a great life, I think, even with all the drama and adventures and the negative adventures, I still see my life as being pretty good.
Now, Susan,
I don't want anything to hurt my consciousness.
And I understand that.
And so that was... anyway, so that's my story of Michael Mukasey.
Okay,
Stockholm Syndrome could be fair.
Okay.
That's actually a fair assessment.
I just want to tie up one other thread, and there are many other elements in your book, and I invite people to read it because the chapters about your incarceration at the Carswell Air Force Base and some of the women you met there are downright chilling. And it's something that most Americans have no concept of, and they deserve to know what their government does to girlfriends of drug dealers and other people who get sent to prison. And many of them were forcibly drugged, including on the Haldol drug that you articulated earlier. But I wanted to tie up one other important thread, and that is that your prosecutor, O'Callaghan, was the guy who drove this case from the beginning. And his, what really surfaced very late in the game is that he resigned from the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York to become a top-level advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign. And he was sent to Alaska to snuff out the Troopergate scandal that was erupting around Sarah Palin's brother-in-law. And so we really need to look at the motivation of Senator McCain and his office, because you believe, and I have no reason to dispute or doubt it, that it was your contact with his office regarding these so-called blue ribbon investigations into WMD and 9/11 that led to the FBI's arrest of you and this whole five-year episode that is a huge affront to our constitutional rights and to your rights as an American citizen. And have you had any further contact with O'Callaghan, or can you update us on what he's doing since he left the McCain campaign?
He is now at Peabody Nixon, and he brags that he provided guidance to the McCain campaign on counterterrorism prosecutions. And here was a man who used his office to cover up the 9/11 investigation, to cover up the 9/11 warnings. He falsified testimony to a federal judge on when I spoke up and believe me, during the proceedings, I did speak up. Once I was incarcerated, I started writing letters to my judge, and I had never done that before. And I, most attorneys will tell you that they hate it when their clients write letters to the judge. But by this time, I realized that I had no attorney who cared for me at all, and so I spoke up. And Edward O'Callaghan falsified his reports to the judge and said, "Oh, Your Honor, no one, the FBI has never verified the 9/11 warnings. The FBI lied to the judge, the Bureau of Prison staff lied to the judge, and this could be impetus for reopening the 9/11 investigation, because what it turns out was that the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Central Justice Office, the Bureau of Prisons and the FBI all had verified the 9/11 warnings, and they chose to conceal that information from the 9/11 Commission. And any of them could have gone to the 9/11 Commission and told the 9/11 Commission about this, but they refused. You see,
mm-hmm.
And so instead of admitting it that they had confirmed it, they didn't just rob me of my rights, they robbed the American people of the right to accountability from their government.
The other thing that O'Callaghan did was force you to continue allowing this guy Tolkien to represent you even after your uncle entered the picture. And you quote your uncle on several occasions saying, "Susan, fire this man." And when you attempted to, O'Callaghan intervened and threatened you, saying that if you exercise your legal right to replace your counsel, that we will throw the we'll double down and make things even worse than sending you to Carswell.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's highly unethical.
While O'Callaghan was still the prosecutor in my case, even after my release from prison, it transpired that McCain was running for office, and it was before O'Callaghan joined his campaign, and McCain began to try to send me back to Carswell. And I was forced to go into court with no attorney present. By this time, I had changed my attorneys, and Sam Tolkien was no longer representing me. And I had a wonderful new attorney named Brian Shaughnessy, who is a top Washington attorney. And he had told the judge, Loretta Preska, who had replaced Mukasey after he retired, that this was the one day that he could not go to court. And so the judge said, "Well, that's the day we're going to have the hearing." And it was a bail revocation hearing to send me back to Carswell. So I was forced to go up to New York without my attorney present. And into the courtroom walks Sam Tolkien,
jeez,
who stands there in front of the judge and says, "Your Honor, as far as I'm concerned, Susan Lindauer is not competent to stand trial at all. She will never be competent until the prosecutor declares that she is competent. And I think that if she's going to have any competency hearing, then she must submit to a three-day inpatient hospital evaluation." And so he came into court and argued for that without my, he was no longer my attorney. And he'd been replaced, and the judge knew he had been replaced.
Well, that's a kangaroo court.
And then my new attorney had to have that overturned, and thankfully I was never subjected to a three-day inpatient evaluation because my new attorney came back and said that's ridiculous. But he had to have the director of Georgetown, George Washington University, Johns Hopkins, and the Washington Psychiatric Institute, all four directors of those mental health departments had to agree and submit letters to the judge saying that there was no reason for it.
Susan, based
four experts say that it was unnecessary.
Susan, based on your book, Sam Talkin should be brought before the bar on charges of egregious misconduct toward you. And why he is still able to practice law after this particular episode is well beyond me.
Well, not only that, he was able to, he received some kind of, well, he may have been paid off. Let's just put it that way.
His
law offices expanded to cover the whole floor of a building in the Wall Street area.
Well, I don't need to speculate about that. I can just tell you that based on your account that he did not represent you in a way that is consistent with his obligation as a public defender or simply as an attorney. And that what is clearly suggested by your account is that he was in collusion with the prosecutor. And that's a kangaroo court, and that is un-American and unacceptable with or without the Patriot Act. We have a constitutional system, and we have a system of criminal justice. And this is just a bizarre disavowal of the fundamental rights that you should enjoy as an American citizen, much less as an asset who served her country. And even if your account is totally self-serving, Susan, what you describe is somebody who really put herself on the line repeatedly to try to help our nation sort through these difficult episodes that are allegedly related to terrorism.
Yeah, that's right. And the great thing about it is, the Patriot Act backfired on the government because I can prove every word of my book is true because we have all the wiretaps. We have, we have wiretaps for 28,000 phone calls, 8,000 emails. And so the government thought they were going to sting me, but really we sting them because we prove that the government was totally informed of everything that I was doing and that members of Congress were contacted over and over and over again, warned to stay out of Iraq because the Iraqi imams were threatening to announce a jihad against American soldiers, and the occupation would be catastrophic, and the weapons of mass destruction would not be there, and so all of the lies that the peace option was beautiful that we had negotiated, and all of the things that we had done were so good that you could have achieved every goal and every objective defined by the United States without firing a shot. You didn't have to kill anybody. You could have had every single thing you wanted, and Saddam would be gone. I mean, what more did you want? You didn't have to kill anybody. He would still be alive, but he wouldn't be ruling Iraq.
Susan Lindauer, I want to thank you for joining us today. I thank you for enduring what you did, and I'm glad that you've written this book, and I hope that more people will learn about your story. In closing, what does it mean to you that in Congress this past week that a significant number of Republicans, I think it's 26 Republicans voted against renewal of the Patriot Act, and there were a total of 148 no votes in the House.
Well, now, as I understand it, if I'm correct about this, what they tried to do was to suspend the rules so they wouldn't have to vote. They tried to sneak the Patriot Act into law without a vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's a procedural thing. Once you've got a quorum in Congress, then it's just a motion to just let it flow through.
Well, you are correct. It was a procedural vote. It fell seven votes short of the two-thirds required to suspend the rules.
Yeah,
but
they tried to suspend the rules. I believe it is despicable that the United States Congress tried to sneak through the Patriot Act in a late night vote. They tried to suspend the rules so that nobody would have to go on the record casting support for this law. And they did not. Once again, you see that Congress does not want to face the people and take responsibility for their actions. Fortunately, a few Republicans joined the Democrats in opposing the motion to suspend the rules. And they have said that if you're going to have the Patriot Act, you're going to have to go on the record and cast your vote. But we expect that in the next couple of weeks, they will bring the Patriot Act up for a vote to renew it again. And we're going to be there to fight it.
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope that your compelling story will give pause to members who want to rubber stamp the Patriot Act, including those who have astoundingly said they want to make it permanent, not even allowing future debate or votes upon it as it hits a renewal point. So, Susan, thanks again for joining us and telling us your story. Your book, Extreme Prejudice, subtitled The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. It's available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Good luck to you, Susan.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And now, comedian satirist Will Durst has a commentary about the 100th birthday of Ronald Wilson Reagan.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here to jump on the Ronald Reagan 100th birth anniversary bandwagon with both feet. Well, to be honest, not so much jump on as use a Sherman tank to slam sideways into, then soak the floorboards with fermented skunk juice. I'm sorry, but I'm barely recovering from the deluge of 2 weeks of wall-to-wall television specials and radio reports and magazine cover stories, all of them presented in that faint beige gauzy haze of selective memory that, unless we're careful, could metastasize into revisionist history. They're even talking about putting his face on the $10 bill. Excuse me? I'm thinking food stamps might be more appropriate. Or considering what he did for the rich, maybe the $10,000 bill. Let's not forget, we're talking about the guy who slept during cabinet meetings, consulted astrology charts for the most propitious times to take foreign policy trips, said that ketchup is a vegetable, and that trees cause pollution. Here's a funny joke for you. What did they call the homeless before Reagan? Mental patients. Now, I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, because taking out Reagan in this country these days is like painting horns on posters of the Pope at a convent. He's Mother Teresa without all the lepers. His own son Ron wrote a book, and in it, he intimated that his dad exhibited vestiges of forgetfulness while president, and the right came down on him like bricks on a grape. In 1994, Reagan wrote a letter to the press announcing that he had Alzheimer's disease. My theory is he wrote the letter 12 years earlier, just forgot to mail it. Then again, maybe he has mystical powers. Both Sarah Palin and Barack Obama paused to sing psalms to the great communicator. And when these two folks can carve time out from their busy schedule of peering into the mirror, we are talking miracles. Let's face it, most presidents are figureheads. Reagan was a hood ornament, something Ms. Palin can only aspire to. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
I believe that if you can't say something nice about a person, you shouldn't say anything at all.
Amen, Will. Let's ride off into the sunset with Ronald on horseback. Thanks for listening to this show.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Smile.